Hello and welcome to Neil Meets, a celebrity edition. I'm Neil Whiteside and this is a chance to rerun some of the interviews that I've done on my mid-morning show here on Cambridge 105 Radio. Some of the celebrities which we've managed to bump into through 2023. And coming up on this programme, we'll meet Richard Hewson. Who's he, you ask? He's the Ra Band, all of them. We'll also meet Lloyd Cole of Lloyd Cole and the Commotions and Brendan Brown of Wheatus. But first, let's meet John McClure. Who's he? He's the Reverend in Reverend and the Makers.
Trying to get famous, trying to make a work of art, trying to be the greatest, so you want to be a music star. Well, you should have known better. Wish I could have wrote letters to my 21-year-old self. You don't want to do this, you're gonna quit the music biz. Imagining the hubris in reckoning someone cares, but nobody's forthcoming. Any port in a storm, but it's hard for my 21-year-old self to tell you not to let such fears dominate any of your best issues. Take care of your friends and keys. Don't get here with the bags of gear. Nobody knew better. Nobody asked whether twas good for my 21. Quit the music biz, imagining the hubris in reckoning someone cares, but nobody's forthcoming. Any port in a storm, but it's hard for my 21-year-old self. There wasn't a career advice, truly the best and worst of times. One day it'll be behind you, and I bet that you might well find that when it's all better, God only knows whether I'll sing to my 21-year-old.
There we are. I love that track, probably for too many good reasons. It's A Letter to My 21-Year-Old Self. It's the current single from Reverend and the Makers, and it's off their new album, Heatwave in the Cold North, which is out tomorrow. And I'm joined on the line by the Reverend himself, John McClure, joins me. John, a very good afternoon to you.
Good morning. Good afternoon, mate. How are you?
Very good, very good. Thanks for joining us, and lovely to catch up with you after all these years. I've always loved your music.
Thanks.
You're coming up on 20 years of this, John.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm starting to become a veteran. Seven albums. Yeah, I mean, you know, you never think you're going to be in a band in your 40s. You sort of think it's going to be a smash and grab raid, don't you? First album, in and out, you know, and here we are. There's that great John Lennon quote, isn't there, where he says, "Life is what happens when you're busy making other plans." It's very much in that place, you know.
Indeed, I mean, and you've just said it there. Was this really just a case of, you know, we'll see how we get on, but I'll probably have to go and get a job in insurance?
Well, funnily enough, before I was in the band, I worked in the call centre in Norwich Union. So I wrote the a lot of the first album whilst sort of desperately trying to get out of the call center. So I always that's kind of you know, reality calling that, and I always like my entire life has been a mission to avoid going back.
I was getting,
you know what I mean?
Yeah, so, yeah. I mean, it must be very difficult. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm like Morgan Freeman in Shawshank now. You know, I'm here for life. I'm a lifer in music, I think.
Well, I mean, seven studio albums don't come from nowhere, do they? That's the thing. You need to keep it up. You need to keep releasing stuff. You need to keep the following. I mean, it's just as hard work as working in a call centre in so many ways, isn't it?
Oh, listen, I mean, weirdly, it's got been going very well lately. Obviously, the three singles have you know, been all over the Radio 2 and stuff, and lots of TV stuff, and the sort of interest in the band has sort of had this real resurgence again. So I feel very lucky, you know, because it's kind of just exploded again, and I'm really busy. And I mean, obviously the album's out tomorrow, and long may it continue. I mean, I don't want to like grumble. It's good to be busy, right? I'm buzzing.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, it's nearly 6 years since Death of a King, but I mean, obviously, a lot's gone on in the world since that time. Were you one of these ones in COVID who sat and wrote copious amounts of music, or did you get the decorating done?
A bit of both, actually. But I was very worried because obviously a lot of my live income comes from live. But then I ended up writing a load of songs for other people and something for an advert and producing a bunch of stuff, and it ended up being like, conversely, a really profitable time. And in the process of that, I met this guy called Danny, who's a Sheffield Wednesday fan like me, and we started spending a bunch of time together, and me and him have written sort of this new album together. So it were like a weird one, COVID, for me. It ended up being a real kind of good experience in lots of ways, and obviously this new direction of the band has come out of that, and all the success that seems to be bringing. So yeah, obviously it was a terrible time for many people, but seems to have given me a new lease of life in some ways.
Good to hear that some people got well, you know, did well out and made their way through and came out the other side. So let's look at this album then, because it's interesting you say that. I mean, listening to it, I love the album, I've got to say, but it really is, if it was on vinyl, it strikes me as sort of side one for when you're in a happy mood and wanting to go out with your mates and party. I mean, we've got the title track off of it, Heatwave in the Cold North, very Barry White inspired sort of track. And then so you flip it over, and there really is quite a lot of sort of soul searching, quite a reflective album there, and in particular with a letter to my 21-year-old self. I mean, crikey! I mean, I've got a few years on you. Oh boy, would I like a word with myself at that age?
Yeah, I mean, I guess like lyrically on this album, I've obviously through the years I've had a bunch of sort of styles lyrically. It's obviously started in that scene with the Arctic Monkeys and that sort of Sheffield kitchen sink drama, social realism thing. I've wrote political songs. Then there's been a hedonistic period, psychedelic period, political songs. This album's very much like an introspective me looking, you know, within myself. And the 21-year-old letter to my 21-year-old self thing's another one that, like, I did an art exhibition in conjunction with the single release. And I had letters from all these, like, crazy people, you know, like Sporty Spice wrote me one, Jeremy Corbyn wrote me one, Brian Eno wrote me one, you know, all these people writing to their selves when they were 21. And I have to say, in writing that song, in 20 years of being in a band, this is the first time I've ever cried whilst writing a song.
Oh, really?
I found it a really emotive thing, you know, because I've made a bunch of mistakes. I'd probably be playing Wembley Stadium now if I'd not met him, you know what I mean? So yeah. I have done some, like, cocked it up a few times. But, I think it's a good experience. And if anybody's listening out there, you can reach me on social media, send a letter to your 21-year-old selves, and I'll try and include it in the exhibition because it's now going to become a podcast. I've been asked to turn it into a podcast, this concept, so it's certainly something that I think people gravitate towards.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Because, you know, it doesn't matter what you do, and you just said it yourself there. You're all right, you made a load of mistakes. Yes, but look at you now. Here we go, seventh studio album. As you say, your singles are getting all over the place. You know, the Nationals are picked up. People wanting you on telly, people wanting you for radio interviews. It worked out okay, didn't it? I think that's probably the one thing I would want to say to 21-year-old me is stop fretting about so many things.
Yeah, well, there's a lyric in the song, actually. It says, be kinder to yourself and know your worth. And there is a thing. I think when you're young, especially, you can be very sort of damning on yourself and very critical and really sort of hold yourself to this really high-minded standard. And yeah, it does. It all turns out. And I mean, if I knew, it's a real cliche to say it, but if I knew then what I know now, I'd have took out world. You know, at least I think that's what makes, you know, your mistakes are the things that make you, aren't you? You know, like even in childhood, if you burn your hand on a kettle or something, you know not to touch a hot kettle again.
That's it.
It's them kind.
How many times were you told not to do it? You have to learn by experience, don't you?
Definitely, you know, and I think that's why, I mean, I get messages all the time about this song in a way that I've never really had it with a song before, where people are like, you know that song, like, you know, like it really, that, right, it's really inspired something inside me. And I don't know what it is with that song. It seems to sort of get people in a different way that I've never really, in all my time in music, I've never inspired like an emotive response in people in that way.
You can imagine how many songs I get sent through in the average week. And the first time I heard it, it did stop me in my tracks, because what it does is it makes everybody just stop for a second and think of themselves. And we don't. Mm. We mask all that. We carry on. We're very busy people. But that song, when I first... Actually, I found myself that it made me stop and think. And, well, okay, what would
Oh, bless
so,
you. Thank you.
I think everyone feels the same. I think you've written a gem.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, it's wonderful to hear that. Obviously, as a songwriter, I think a lot of people of my era of bands, they sort of go around playing their early material or maybe release songs that are maybe not quite as good. And I really do feel like I'm entering a purple patch as a songwriter, and having people buzzing on your new material is what you want to hear, you know, because you don't just want to go around playing like the well-known ones from years ago. That's,
no.
It's a little bit, as an entertainer, as a songwriter, it's a bit shallow, that experience. It's like you're doing karaoke to your own songs, you know.
Yeah.
you want to touch people with the new songs. So it's very, very lovely to hear you saying that.
No, and I mean, you've got some dates coming up, so you're getting back out on the road, which has got to be a good thing. And these, you know, songs like Heatwave in the Cold North, that's going to be a great one amongst the crowds, isn't it?
Definitely, yeah. I mean, we had a really kind of successful tour earlier on in the year where with the full band, which were wonderful. And then the next thing in June, I'm going to go out with the acoustic guitar, and I'm going to do kind of a bit of a strip thing, and you can buy like the album and a ticket for like 15 quid or something. We've kept it real reasonable. And I do like the acoustic things because I can have a natter and like talk a bit of twaddling between songs and have a bit less serious, you know. You can have a bit of fun with it and invite local artists to come and play and all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, we're doing a bunch of kind of smaller acoustic dates, like literally everywhere. If you look on our website, you can see and come and join us.
Sounds amazing. Now, one of the things I was going to ask you was, because when your music was first coming out, everything was on CD, and now there's been this vinyl resurgence. And so I was just doing a little bit of research into whether Heatwave in the Cold North was available on vinyl, and I come across this blood red orange sunset pressing in vinyl. Only 1,000 copies, sold out. I mean, blimey, people do want to get, they really want to get their hands on this.
Yeah, no, we're hoping for a bit of a top 10, actually. I think like the sales have been really good. And yeah, the Blood Record, they're really beautiful, actually, those. But there's still the main black vinyl available. And I have to say, I mean, you know, I'm 41, so I'm probably biased, but I think records sound great on vinyl. It's the way that the artist intended you to hear it, without skipping.
Totally agree.
You know, without the compression that comes with streaming. I mean, on the subject of streaming, there is this myth that, oh, I'll stream the album, that'll help push the band. If you love a band, really, you need to buy the album. I could stream someone's album every day for 3 years, and I still wouldn't give them the same money as if I bought the thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's just, you know, and I think you've got to, as a fan of a band, or if you believe in a band, or you believe someone's, it's like if I see a busker in town and they do it like doing something great, I give them a quid. I do, because I think we need to sort of look after the artists. I think musicians and artists occupy a special place in society, and if we don't love them and cherish them and support them, then they go away, don't they? You
totally
know what I mean?
Agree. So I think, totally agree. I think musicians are the fifth emergency service. They get musicians and music get the rest of us through so many difficult patches in our lives, and you're also there for all the good stuff too. So absolutely, musicians are the fifth emergency service in my book. So.
Oh, I like that. That's a great... I might borrow that, actually.
No,
that's
you
great,
go right ahead.
There's that saying, isn't there, about, like, you know, a person needs bread and roses.
Yes.
And I think this is the thing with music. It does something for your soul that I think, like, it's almost unquantifiable, isn't it? You know what I mean? You can't measure it, but it's there for people, you know. And
it's what makes us human. It's what makes us human.
There we go.
John,
I didn't expect to be delving into philosophy at the end of this interview.
I was going to say, we've done well. There's a song in there somewhere, John, you know that.
Absolutely.
Listen, good luck with the new album. It's lovely to have you back and around. Good luck with the dates as well. Keep the music coming. Long may this run continue. John McClure from Reverend Makers. Thanks for joining me, John.
I've really enjoyed talking to you. Take care.
Across the city and South Cambridgeshire.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
Aficionado, you may well know that track. If not, you've just been introduced to something that's been around for 40 years and was made famous by Stranger Things and went viral on TikTok. It's called Message from the Stars by the Ra Band. You know them, of course, from The Crunch and Clouds Across the Moon. Guess what? I've got the entire Ra Band on the other end of the line. Hello, Richard.
Hello. Hello, yes, I suppose it's all, well, not entire. We put a few other extra instruments on as well. But basically, yes.
It is, I mean, that is it, isn't it? RA is your initials, R-A-H.
Exactly.
And that was how it all started for you. You started as an arranger, though, didn't you? And you've worked with some amazing artists on that. But what persuaded you to give it a go and go solo?
Well, as you said, I started as an arranger with lots of people from the Beatles right down to not nobody beginning with Zed, but lots of famous artists from across the world. And it was, I loved it. I loved doing the orchestrations because that was what I went to college to learn. And as I was a jazz guitar player originally, so I loved anything to do with guitars and basses because I could play those. And then I did it for, well, I suppose from the first record I ever did was Those Were the Days, which was a lucky break because it went straight to number one around the world, which gave me a big opening for, you know, any arrangements come along, I'd do them happily. But after sort of 10 years of that, I suddenly began to think, because I don't know whether you know this, but arrangers never get royalties for records. So for all that, you know, I mean, Mary Hopkins' record was massive, and I think I got 25 quid for that.
No.
And you don't get a royalty. That's it. I tell you what, I went up in price, so Long and Winding Road, I made 40 quid.
Bless you.
Yeah, so basically that's why I thought, really, I've got to start making my own tunes, producing my own tunes, otherwise I'm never going to survive. So I had a little multi-track recorder, and I played that. In 1977, I thought, I'm going to write a pop tune. I was a jazz player. I didn't know anything about pop music. So I thought, I'll play the guitar, which I can, bass, because it's very similar, keyboards, no synths. Now, a lot of people thought there were synths on that.
I thought there were.
It was all guitar through pedals and an electric guitar, piano through pedals that made that sort of crunchy sound, hence the title. And that was my first pop record. And it took me a while, but I got it released and it went to number 6 in the chart.
Yeah, I remember it. Well, it's a great track. It's a great
there
track.
There you go.
And then along comes Clouds Across the Moon. This one, you know, in the 80s, you were pretty much the avant-garde on all this stuff.
Well, I mean, I suppose the crunch was well left field, and I think that's probably why it happened. And I used my jazz musician friends to do the overdubs, and it had that jazzy appeal. And then I changed tack a bit and got more into vocals, because I was only doing instrumentals at the time, did a couple of instrumental albums. But then I said, I think I'd get a bit further if I could actually have a vocal record, you know, and try and crack the pop charts again. Anyway, I wrote this little tune called Perfume God. That was the first one I tried with a vocal. And my then wife, who was a brilliant musician, not a singer, she's a brilliant pianist. She could read anything if you wrote it on the paper. So I wrote out the lyrics and the notes for her to sing. And I said, just to do a demo, I said, why don't you come and demo this for me? And I'll get a real singer. Ooh, a bit rude, don't it? But she came in and did it with that very nice voice, and I thought, you know what, this really works. It's not diva-ish, it's nothing like a soul singer, but it worked with the track. And that was my first attempt at writing a song, a proper song, you know, with words. And then Clouds Across the Moon came shortly after that.
And the rest really is history. And I mean, you know, fast forwarding now, you know, you've claimed your place in pop history in that way. And obviously, as you say, with songs like Long and Winding Road and Mary, you know, your name appears several times if you Google it. And if you Google music history, up it comes. But now along comes Stranger Things, which, I mean, is well known for its detail. And for like anything, they get out quirky little bits of gear. They get out the old computer games or the old board games that the people. And along comes Message from the Stars, and then suddenly off it goes, and you're faced with, you're now a TikTok sensation and things like that. How did that feel? How did you get wind of that suddenly things weren't quite what they sent?
Well, you couldn't make it up, really, because it's the sort of thing that just happened. We didn't promote it to TikTok or promote it to the American kids, because it was kids in Los Angeles picked it up first. That's where it started. Back in February last year, somebody noticed a big spike in Messages from the Stars, and we looked up through Spotify where it was coming from, and it was coming from Los Angeles, kids in Los Angeles. And, you know, they were making little video, dancing, speeding it up, slowing it down. I mean, amazing. And I thought, wow, how has this happened then? somebody, they have, I think over there, things called influencers, guys called
influencers. That's right, yeah.
And they probably said, hey, you got to listen to the Rare Band, it's amazing. And then the kids go, yeah, it is, really cool. And it did, and off it went, 300 million streams or whatever it was last week, to last count. But amazing, couldn't make it up.
I love the fact that you've embraced all this, because there's now a YouTube video about your career. So you've not gone, oh, this is all modern stuff, oh, it means nothing to me. You've actually embraced it. You're right in there, aren't you? And you're still producing music.
Yeah, I am, and I really like the modern electronic dance music, because that's where I started, basically, in jazz. And I think that today it's almost the closest thing to jazz for me, and I still love all that. You know, a lot of people say to me, oh, they don't like them like they used to, do they? People of my generation say that. I said, no, it's much better now.
You'll go down well. You're allowed to say things like that, though. You're royalty. You're okay.
You can cut that out if you want.
Now, as you said, though, you've only ever performed live once in all these years, and that was very recently, June last year. But we've got a gig coming up in November.
Yeah. What happened was that the Jazz Cafe, which is a well-known venue in London, invited me, not knowing that it wasn't a band, to appear one night last June. And I said, well, thought to myself, I told my son, I said, well, I can't do it, Dan, because I played all the instruments, you know, except the
keep you busy,
and he said, wait a minute, Dad, because he's a brilliant musician, much cleverer than me. And he said, Dad, I could put a band together. I've got some great mates, and he did. He put a band together and three girl singers, and it was amazing. He transcribed all the old tunes that we played on the set, and carefully wrote all the parts for the guys, and then a couple of rehearsals, and I couldn't believe it. All I had to do was press a little button for the samples at the beginning.
Wow. I mean, from your point of view, though, as a composer, though, and as you say, having done all this yourself, to actually just sort of stand back a little bit and hear a whole group of people do it, that must have been actually really quite an experience.
It superseded what I thought it was going to be. It was amazing. These guys, I mean, they're all brilliant players anyway. Days, the kids today are so clever, and kids, I mean, they're in their 30s, but they played, you know, I went to a rehearsal and I thought, my god, that sounds almost better than the record, and everybody was blown away. All the, you know, it was a full house, and the fans were going crazy. And so we're doing, as I say, he, my son, and I, because I do the sample bits, are playing in Amira, which is a place I haven't been to before, London Bridge area, 25th of November, so be there or be square.
Well, and you're very right, be there or be square. And I mean, is this tempting you to do a bit more of this? I mean, forgive me, but you know, you're not the youngster you were back in the 70s and 80s when all this started, but you seem to me like you're very much up for this.
Yeah, I am. What else would I do, sort of thing? I'm no good as a gardener. I don't do pipe and slippers, or I'm in my dotage. I just love music, and it drives my wife crazy. But I come into this studio where I'm sitting now every day, weekdays, not allowed on weekends. Every day I come in after I walk the dogs. That's the first important thing. Walk the dogs, then come in the studio about 10:30, stay until 1 o'clock, come out for lunch, then back in at 2, out at 4 for tea. Ooh, we're missing it. And then on to 6 o'clock when I stop. That's it. But I do that every day. Even if you don't come out with something, you've got to go in there and try. And today I came up with the best I've ever done.
Really? Oh, my goodness me. But is that's always the way, is it? Everything's the best you've ever done? Or is this a real treat coming up?
Oh, it's a real treat. But you have to say that, because otherwise you'd lose faith in it. No, you have to have faith in it. I have to. As long as I've got faith in it, I hope somebody else will. Well, but it's great. I can tell you now.
We're going to look forward to that, because there are four albums of unreleased material coming up. So you must, as you say, if this is what you do every day, my God, you must have a pile to get through.
Well, I have. And funnily enough, I had to go and buy a new shed the other day. A new shed. How about that? I bought a lovely big shed in the garden where I've got all my multi-tracks, because I just didn't have any room in the studio anymore to put some, but they're all in there.
Oh,
loads of them.
Goodness.
I think it's about 100 24-track 2-inch tapes in there. Full
goodness.
Of music.
Goodness me. Well, Richard, it's just absolutely a joy to meet you. I never thought for 1 minute back in 1977 when I bought The Crunch on a 7-inch single from my local shop in Letchworth that all these years later I'd be chatting to the man who did it. But they're great tunes, so it's lovely to have an opportunity to say thank you for it. I love the fact that modern kids have caught on to this and have gone, do you know what? That is good music. Good. That means there is hope for the world yet. And I just love the fact that you're still doing it. So long may it continue. Richard, thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
Well, there we are. If you look back over time, we'll know that he's had lost weekends. He's dealt with rattlesnakes. A lot of his early life was surrounded with commotion, but I can happily report that Lloyd Cole is now warm by the fire. So at last he's rested up. Here he is, you know, best part of 40 years since Lloyd Cole and the Commotions got underway. New album out, and he joins me on the line from Massachusetts. Lloyd, very good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon to you. Good morning over here, but
Yes, I mean, you really have. You pretty much up sticks and went over to the States pretty much after the Commotions broke up. So are you still an Englishman abroad, or have you slowly Americanized yourself over the years?
I suppose I've inevitably done that somewhat, but I had no desire to take American citizenship. I couldn't take the Pledge of Allegiance. I'm still British. I wish I was still European.
Yes. Hear, hear. Amen to that. Can I just use that clip? Right. I mean, looking back at Lloyd Cole and the Commotions, I mean, 4 top 20 albums, 5 top 40 singles in the space of 5 years. That stamps your mark, doesn't it? When you do something like that, people take you seriously because that's a body of work straight off the bat. And that launched a solo career that's been going strong ever since.
I wouldn't say it's been going strong ever since. I think I went steadily downhill for the first 5 or 6 years. Had a little bit of a resurgence with Love Story in the middle of the 90s, then went steeply downhill to the mid-2000s. But since about 2010, I have a theory that the British people don't like middle-aged artists. They only like young people and old people. And now I'm old, things seem to be a little better.
Yeah, they love that revival concert type thing, don't they? But was the when you formed Lloyd Cole and the Commotions, that kind of puts the name of it, there was always a solo career in mind, was it? It's not like when Gary Barlow is in Take That, and it wasn't Gary Barlow and Take That, was it? It was a case of... So was that always the plan for you to go solo?
No, absolutely not. In fact, I was never feeling like I was equipped to be a solo artist. And I only became a solo artist when the band split up, I suppose because I subliminally assimilated a lot of skills from the other members of the band. Because I was by far the least talented member of the band in terms of the musicianship. I played rhythm guitar, and my job was really to come up with the ideas, and they were the players. But I moved to New York, got a demo studio together, and found out, oh, for heaven's sake, I can arrange strings. I didn't know I could do that. I can program drums. I didn't know I could do that. So no, it was not the plan. It was just too difficult being in a band long term. I was happy to walk away from music if I wasn't able to be a solo artist.
And you use a studio at home now. You've got an attic studio, if I'm right. And I'm looking at you on Zoom now. I can see lights blinking. It's a well-equipped studio. Is that how you like to work? Do you like to sort of work in isolation, get things together, bring people in as you need them now?
No. I really don't. I don't mind that process when I'm trying to establish the essence of a project. I think to a large extent, if you're not in a band, you have to be on your own for a while to get the feel of a project. But then it would be lovely to go somewhere else and be in a room with a bunch of musicians. And that was the plan for this album until COVID happened.
But I guess in that way, handy that you've got the studio then.
And handy that Neil and Blair have got theirs as well. And we were able to do stuff remotely. I was on FaceTime to Chris Hughes, the producer, 3 or 4 times every week. And we only got together for the mixing. And I kindly brought him a gift for the mixing, which was COVID.
Oh, that went down well then. I mean, with COVID, were you one of these people who sat and copiously wrote, or was it a case of, no, actually, I'm going to use this opportunity to sort the garage out?
A bit of both. Right. When I first got home after our touring was shut down, I started work on what became On Pain. I did clear out the garage and the basement, as we call it over here, the cellar. And then after a couple of months, I realized that none of these things were going to help me pay my mortgage. And I got quite frightened because there was no end in sight. And so I started doing cottage industry type things. I started selling handwritten lyrics and people loved it. And I started a thing called a Patreon page, which is still going. And it's now, I think it's about 2,000 entries and 3,000 photographs and 500 audio files or something. It's a sort of multimedia memoir. And that paid the mortgage up to the point where when the dates had been rescheduled and then postponed again and rescheduled and postponed again, when we finally thought, okay, these are going to happen, then I started working on the album again, and we finished it last October.
Indeed, indeed. And listening to the album, I mean, it's got some unashamedly wonderful synth tracks, but kind of picking up on what you were saying about the British public in particular, you know, not liking middle-aged musicians, a lot of people harking back now 40 years to the 1980s and going, yeah, there are bits about that sound that are just, in a way, so unique. And I love the way you've used those. The synths aren't just sort of tinkling away in the background. They're front and centre on so many tracks.
Yeah, I mean, I think we think about synths as being an 80 thing because those synthesizers that we still use were primarily invented in the 1980s. Before the 80s, synthesizers were like mini Moogs, which the Beatles had a mini Moog, but it was monophonic. You couldn't play chords on it. But when the Prophet 5 and then the DX7 came out, it was a game changer. All of a sudden, bands had access to sounds that they would have had to use an orchestra for before.
Yeah.
And so I think that's why we think of the 80s in terms of synths. But I think synths are really from the 80s until now. They've never been away.
But I guess as well, when they first came in, that was, it was almost like, I remember Phil Collins, I think, saying, you know, that's it, drummers are unemployed from here on out. But that's not the way it is, and it's certainly not the way on your album, is it? Those live musicians and all the traditional instruments are back and working quite nicely alongside now. I love the new sound of the music you're doing.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, it's a combination of musicians playing and then me cutting up the parts and putting them back together again. It's actually a bit like that Music Concrete they used to make in before there were multi-track recorders, when people used to record a sound onto a tape, like what she called Delia Derbyshire, mm-hmm. somebody Derbyshire, the BBC woman, and they would take bits of tape and cut them up to create soundscapes. Well, I can now do that in my computer quite easily. Mm. And there's a lot of playing on the record, but my guitar playing that you hear on the single, for example, Warm by the Fire, I didn't play it like that. I played it quite differently, and it was quite boring. And I was like, this is not quite right. I'm going to move this around until I'm happy with it.
Brilliant, brilliant. All right, so here we are. The album's now ready to go. That's good. We've got the music coming out. And you're touring to celebrate. And you're coming to Cambridge, a place you've played before.
I've been to Cambridge many times recently, but mostly it's been in the Junction. But I'm back with a band this time, which is an interesting combination of old and new. It's Neil and Blair and I, who were the three original members of the Commotions, but with a new drummer from Glasgow, who's a half Icelandic, half Scot, and she's fantastic. So we're not going to be putting on a retro show.
Right.
We're going to be a new band. We're going to be playing old songs, but we're not going to be trying to sound like the Commotions. I think to try and sound like what you sounded like when you were 24, when you're 62, would be in some way rather perverse.
Yeah.
But we're going to be awesome.
Indeed you are. And, I mean, you seem very settled. You seem very calm. You seem to have found the place you want to be now. You're saying that, you know, you've had those times where you were, you know, your career was down. You seem quite settled and happy with this.
No, absolutely not back to where I'd like to be. I would like considerably more exposure, and I'd like to know that more people were hearing my music. I have the evidence to prove that not that many are hearing it still. So I'm still trying to get back to a position of more comfort and of economic security. I haven't had that since 1994.
Well, the trouble, I guess, is, isn't it? But in the early days, it was the radio stations and physical sales of stuff. The trouble with streaming nowadays is that, you know, every artist tells us there's not the money in it. And that's the trouble when you're trying to reach new audiences nowadays, isn't it?
Absolutely. When we started out, we used to tour to promote records. Now we make records so we can tour.
Mm. Yes. Yeah,
thankfully, I still love making records.
And do you still like touring?
Absolutely. I actually learned to love touring when I had to do it in the early 2000s. I went out on my own with an acoustic guitar and I sort of learned to be a performer. I think with the Commotions, it felt more like we were reciting something as opposed to performing. But when it's just you on stage with one guitar, you have to learn to project.
Indeed. Well, listen, you're playing the Corn Exchange on the 24th of October. It's going to be a belting gig. Happy to be back touring in the UK. Do you do much touring out in the States?
I do some, but I can't bring a band over to the States. The market won't support that in terms of, you know, the demand for my shows. Yeah, I tour all over the world. I'm going to Australia and New Zealand, I think, after the UK and Europe. That's the plan anyway. The only places I've never really toured are east of the old Iron Curtain and China. I've toured in Japan a few times, been to Singapore once, which was fantastic. So having something take you around the world is really a blessing.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. Well, you might want to just steer clear of the Iron Curtain, as you say, for now. Probably not the best place to go, but maybe another day. Listen, it's been great to meet you. Great to catch up. And good luck with the new album. It's on Pain, it's out and about, and the singles are a great lead into that. Lloyd Cole, thanks so much indeed for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
Cambridge 105 Radio. Tubes suck.
You don't need me to back announce that for you. It's Wheatus, Teenage Dirtbag. Of course it is. We've been singing it since forever knows when. Wheatus coming to Cambridge. First time in a while. They'll be playing The Junction in November. And the man himself, Brendan, BBB to his friends, is on the line. Brendan, very good morning to you.
Hello, good morning to you. Yeah, I think my morning might be a little bit earlier than your morning here in New York, but yeah, okay. Yes,
absolutely. Listen, thanks for joining us. I mean, when you sit and look back, it's 30-odd years nearly, isn't it, for Teenage
Dirtbag? Oh, wow, yeah. Yeah, the first time I ever hit the road for real as a musician, I was opening up for Joan Jett and the Blackhearts in 1996, so we are fast approaching. That was another band. That wasn't Wheatus, but fast approaching my, like you said, 30th. Being a pro musician. Wow.
I'm sorry to start your day like that, but yeah, I mean, but you, yeah,
it got me feeling old in the morning.
Sorry, fella. But from what I've read of it, though, you kind of, unlike other bands where, oh well, we were just jamming and we got discovered, you set out, didn't you? You hired them out. You're like, right, we're gonna, you got people in, you were gonna make it.
Well, we were very careful, let's just put it that way. It took a long time before I was comfortable showing anybody the work I was doing for Wheatus. And I was in a lot of other projects during that time, a few of which actually, one of which had a major label deal. And I was sort of the writer and arranger on that and the guitar player. And then I kind of got pushed to the side when it was time to talk business. So I learned that lesson. But the whole while I was working on the Wheatus stuff, and I just didn't feel safe showing it to anybody. I was also developing my voice and exactly what I was going to sound like and what the band would be like. And times were also changing. There were these whispers of MP3 and things like that in the late 90s. I was fortunate enough to work for a VPN company went back then. Got some early tech info about what might be coming, and it was all luck, really. That whole thing, you know.
Well, I don't know. Right, I think it right sounds there to me like, yeah. Well, I said there's a bit of shrewd operating as well in there, because so many others were floundering around and sort of scarpering about at that time, and you kind of had your eye on it. Is that the Brooklyn boy in you? Because you're a New York born and bred job. Right? Is that the Brooklyn boy?
I grew up on Long Island. I moved to New York City in '96, Lower East Side, as soon as I got out of college, and I working class family. My dad sold cars. My mom worked full time as an interior decorator, and my grandmother, even who lived with us, worked as a medical secretary. And there was no sitting around, you know. And so I felt the need to watch the pennies early on, just from the way I was raised. So I knew that there were fortunes that were very easy to lose in the music industry. Yes. And again, when we signed a record deal, we opted for no advance. We just took a small recording fund. The record didn't cost much at all. We did it at my mom's house. Everything on the cheap, cutting corners, working as hard as we could. Yeah, I guess it was a bit of sort of like, maybe we call it fear. You know,
well, a bit of fear never hurts. Fear never hurts, does it? Focuses the mind in my book. But when you go along and then you hit something like Teenage Dirtbag fairly early on, that must have been a great bit of training for you then, because suddenly here it comes. Teenage Dirtbag, exactly. Global hit.
Exactly. And it was a bit of a challenge to try and figure out, well, what part of what we're experiencing here has always been happening in the music industry, and what part of it is this novel situation where the internet is becoming a thing, and these old companies are not designed for that, right? They're not equipped for the new media that they're trying to sell, which is a strange paradox. But we were right on that cusp where we stayed with the major labels after our first release, we would probably have wound up in a lot of trouble. Many bands from that generation were shelved or had their records, and they didn't release our second, right? And I'm not saying that there was any opportunity for them to treat us the right way. But we were fortunate in that when we left the major label system, we were able to take that second album with us and own the master. So they only got one album out of us, which we re-recorded these past few years, and now own the only, it seems, multi-track master of Teenage Dirtbag and the first album. So it was like a weird, like, it's almost like we stepped onto the Titanic right before it hit the iceberg, and we're able to step off of it right before it sank.
Oh my goodness, that's a great analogy. That is a great analogy. And I mean, in terms of the band members, you know, as with so many rock bands, you know, you're sort of the original surviving member, if you like, and there's been quite a list. I mean, so much so that on your Wikipedia page, there's a bit of a timeline for when people join and people go and people come back. But you've toured as an original lineup and the latest lineup. So obviously the bonds and everything are all still there from those early days.
It's a big extended family. My partner, Gabrielle, who is currently in Wheatus, is one of the singers, is doing a solo project with Phil Jimenez from the first album. He was my co-producer then. I still talk to Mike McCabe. My brother is, of course, my brother who lives 30 minutes away from me in New Jersey. So we kind of like, it's always been this extended family. And, you know, just this past summer, I had one of our old bass players, Nick DiPiero, come into this very studio and help me work on some sounds because the others had other obligations during the summer. So it's very much a revolving door. Nobody's really truly on the outs ever. It's just more like a music family, and we all have ideas and we try and help each other out. And everybody knows that the Wheatus thing has been my weird thing from the get-go because I started it alone, frankly. Yeah. I spent 2 years working on the music without showing a soul. So I think that there's that understanding from long, long ago that you know, we're all going to be called upon at some point to work on each other's music, and that happens all the time.
So, now, you said there about you did so much of it on your own, especially in those early days in the songwriting and production. Do you still do that now, or do others sort of chip up and go, you could do a bass line like this, or is it like, you know, you don't ever ask that of Brendan?
Well, so it's funny. I have very particular ideas in the pre-production process, and then when we get in, once Matthew has learned the bass line that I'm thinking of, or Gabrielle's learned the harmonies I'm thinking of, once we've got that down, then we start tinkering, right? Once this silly idea is out of the head, then we have to test its value, so to speak, and that's when we start deconstructing and reconstructing, and that's when the ideas kind of flow. Many times Matthew has, you know, just sort of improvised a note somewhere, and I've gone, oh, that's a different harmony. Let's try that one. Well, no, actually put that one over here where you were playing the other one. You know, like it begins to turn into a stew at some point. Just before we started speaking, I was working on a Christmas song. I got here at the studio at about 7:15 in the morning and cranked up the laptop and started working on this Christmas original that we're working on for December. So, and that's very much a solitary process. There's no noise. I'm have my headphones in really quietly, and I'm just sort of like plugging away at these concepts until a song emerges. It's both. It's both. Really.
Interesting. All right. Well, we look forward to that Christmas song. You've let that cat out of the bag now. That's put you on a deadline because we want it for Christmas. We want it for Christmas this year, not Christmas next.
Working on it.
So it's been four
Christmas
years.
Christmas in August.
Yes, exactly. That's always the trouble, isn't it? So you were last in the UK in 2019. It's been 2017 since you last played in Cambridge, though.
That's right. But I always feel so such fond feelings about the place because, first of all, obviously the history everybody knows, but we did one time play during a period where we weren't getting many calls. We got a call from King's College, and they were graduating and they wanted somebody to play their final commencement ball.
Oh, for the May Balls. Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Oh.
And it was so special and so completely bizarre and wonderful, and we were really proud and honored to be a part of it. And we got to play a full rock show on this, you know, precious piece of, I don't know how old, maybe 800-year-old green that they have in the campus there, and that they're not allowed to walk on unless it's this one day, you know. Yes. And we were part of it, and I thought, oh man, if they only knew, they invited these Long Island guys in here to do this like stupid show, like, you know. But it's those kinds of moments. Like, I remember Cambridge in that way. It was one of the places that we began to work heavily again after, you know, the financial crisis 2009, sure, things kind of like settled down a little bit. So Yeah, it'll always be we're headed back to Cambridge.
You know? Well, we're looking forward to welcoming you back to the Junction in November. Very near time to wrap up, but you mentioned, you just let slip, that this you're using the same microphone in your studio now that Dolly Parton uses, and that anything Dolly does is all right with you. Is that the sort of
That's
thing?
That's correct.
What is it about the way, is it the way she produces her music or what?
Do you mean besides that she's perfect?
Oh, okay. I'll take your point. Yeah.
I mean, she's, first of all, she's a brilliant songwriter. Let's just get that out of the way, right?
Yeah.
And she can shred the guitar on all of her stuff. She just put out a rock record. I don't know if any of you know that.
It's on our playlist.
Great. It's a great rock record she just put out. And, you know, she's, obviously, you can say that she's an American legend and all of that stuff, but what she really is at the core is an excellent musician, right? She knows, she picked that microphone. She knows what that thing sounds like. She knows everything there is to know about this process over these years. And for that reason, if Dolly does it, we do it.
That's it. That's going to be my quote now for next time I play the next Wheaters track. And we are going to play a track right after the break. We're going to play Valentine. And I'm always, don't forget, if Wheaters say, if Dolly does it, we do it. Brendan, it's been a joy to meet you. Can't wait for you to get over here and play the Junction in November. It's going to be great.
Yes.
And we're looking forward to that Christmas single as well. Brendan, thanks so much indeed for joining me.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Take care.
Cambridge 105 Radio.